Sunday school teachers walk in the door. One of our past presidents, Patty Lovett, and David and Heidi. We're so glad that y'all all made it here. This isn't about hypertension and diabetes. I'm a little bit out of place. It's also the first time I've actually done a PowerPoint presentation. So it's been a learning experience for me. Florence. Why Florence? Well, go back to 1850. There wasn't a Florence. The reason Florence is here is because of money and cotton, and how do you get cotton to market? All the cotton was shipped out through Charleston. Charleston wanted more of the business because there was a depression, and they built railroads, and they started building the railroad northeast to get the cotton out of the PD area. Wilmington was a port in North Carolina, and they wanted some of that business. And they built the Wilmington and Manchester Railroad. Manchester was a little community near Sumter. And you could go all the way up to the old town of Sherall, and another railroad was being started and funded, the Sherall-Darlington Railroad. Darlington is an old city established in 1785. So you had this competition, and they needed a point to be able to exchange not only passengers, but the freight. And they figured out that the best place, given the swampland around and the rivers, you know, unless you wanted to go over old horse trails, was to build a railroad. And they found the point 10 miles south of Darlington, and in about 1852, built a little depot. And this was where Sherall is, and the Sherall-Darlington Railroad. This goes up into North Carolina from Wilmington all the way over to the Sumter area, Manchester. And here comes the Northeast Railroad from in Charleston, down south. So, William Harley was the president of the Wilmington and Manchester Railroad, so we'll make Harleyville wrong. It was another town, Hardyville. Sounds too close. So, he named it for his daughter, Florence Henning Harley. And that's how the town got its name. It was nothing more than a railroad platform in about 1852-ish. But there was money to be made, the trains ran, people got the cotton to market. And this is a map of where it all came together about four blocks from here. And you had the railroad, the Sherall-Darlington Railroad here. You had the Northeast Railroad coming up from Charleston and then toward Sumter and toward Wilmington. Okay? And this was the point of town, point where it interested, or excuse me, where they all intersected. And actually right here was where the Jacoby House was. We'll get that to that in a minute. So the town was laid out about 1858. And in 10 years after the Civil War, there were over 700 families in Florence. Most of the people worked for the railroad, over half of them. And there was commerce. There was money to be made. There were Jewish merchants around, and Jews came to town. By 1865, there were 85 families in Florence and Darlington and Georgetown and all the surrounding towns in the PD area. So we were all part of it. In 1857, Morris Jacoby came to Florence and established the hotel. This is the Jacoby House, and it stayed. It was added on to, and finally, as it got really old in 1938, it was torn down. And this was a place where the traveling Jewish salesman could stay. And this was a very successful hotel, along with the Gamble Hotel and others in Florence. You had a lot of traffic coming through. William Johnson, who was an African-American artist, painted a rendition of the hotel back in 1930, which is an oil painting. One of the first people to come to town was a merchant called John Cooker. He was a pharmacist, but basically opened a dry goods store in 1866. And he was a warden, which is a councilman, first. And he totally in his life served 9 years as a councilman, but he was the second mayor, the second intendant, from 1872 until 1874. They're apparently elected him in the council meeting once a year, and he got it in 1872 and again, although they couldn't find the records in 1873, I found records that he gave it up in 74 to somebody else. John Chase, I believe, was the first mayor. In later life, he got into the loan business and real estate and opened the Commercial Savings Bank of Florence. And his home was on the corner of Palmetto and Irby Street until the late 1940s. And it was torn down to, let's see how old people are. It was torn down to make a Howard Johnson's. And after that, it was a little Chinese restaurant. Too bad. This was a very nice house. But that corner is dead center of Florence now. Abram Weinberg moved in 1871. He established a general merchandise store. He also was on the city council. Aaron Baruch. He owned a store on Front Street, which is now Dargan Street. Now Baruti Street. And he served as a magistrate and on the town council. And eventually, he got elected sheriff of Darlington County. He was a crook. Now, I can't tell you too much about him. I can tell you that... all right, we said we weren't going political, right? I can tell you that he apparently was the only Republican that was in the Jewish community. But... that was back in pretty old politics. Anyway, I did find warrants and stuff that he served a stack about that high in the county historical commission. Julius DeLong arrived in Florence in 1870. He became an attorney. Harold, I believe, told me that he worked for one of the railroads.
He was the attorney for the Northeast Railroad.
Okay. David Steinberger arrived in 1872. He opened a store. Isaac Sulzbacher opened a jewelry store. The reason I'm putting them up there was they were very successful in a committee in the late 1880s that promoted making Florence a separate county. And, in fact, in 1888, the political move was made, and Florence County was formed mostly from Darlington County, a little bit of Colleton and Marion County. A.A. Cohen from Prussia started in Weinberg's store as a clerk. He opened his own store and other successful businesses. He was director of the Bank of Florence and held a lot of other positions in trust. People really liked him. This is a block on East Evans Street. Oops. Sorry about that. Where his store, and if you blow this up and work on the contrast, you can see his name right there on the storefront. So he was a very successful merchant. Well, he had a lot of Jews in Florence. Sometimes they pass away. What do you do with them? You kind of had to take them to Charleston or another town that had a sacred burial ground for Jews. So they realized they needed a cemetery, and October 26, 1887, the Florence Hebrew Benevolent Association was formed. They applied for a charter from the state to unite the Hebrews of Florence and surrounding country into a fraternal and benevolent organization to assist the needy Israelites and to purchase and maintain a suitable burial ground. The names on the charter: David Sternberger, S. Elias, Julius DeJong, and Harris Joseph. Within a month, they purchased land right up just south of where the original Florence plant was, about three-quarters of a mile right along the railroad. And for $50, this was used to build a cemetery. A little later, A.A. Cohen made a motion to order books and make a Sunday school for all children of Israelite parents. That's being very inclusive. Didn't have to be a member, but they wanted to educate the kids. Does this sound familiar? Whether or not they were members of the association. Now, around the turn of the century, most of the Jews that were here were of German descent. Around the turn of the century, you had Eastern European Jews coming in, Russian, and you had a small number of Orthodox Jews come to Florence. And in 1912, on September 27th, they applied to the state of South Carolina to incorporate as Beth Israel Congregation. That's the original charter. It's hanging on the wall somewhere around here. I think it's in the foyer. Okay, the original trustees were B. Patz, Maurice Rosenfeld, and I. Silverman. Now, yes, Maurice Rosenfeld, that's Nat Rosenfeld's grandparents. After a few years, the Jews of Florence realized that the town wasn't quite big enough to have two congregations. You had an Orthodox group and you had a Reform group, and they had to compromise. And finally, in 1922, the Hebrew Benevolent Association, which was Reform, and Beth Israel Congregation, which was Orthodox, merged. They decided they'd do Sunday school and services in the Reform tradition, High Holy Days in the Orthodox tradition. And we still try to be sensitive to everybody as best we can. Well, need to get a rabbi. So, there was a really good rabbi down in Charleston, always seemed to be. Rabbi Jacob Raisin was hired in 1922 to come to Florence one Sunday a month to serve Beth Israel. He was already coming to Darlington one Sunday a month, and he actually would split the day between the two congregations. Beth Israel joined the Union of American Hebrew Congregations in 1931, has been a member in good standing most of the time ever since. And I see somebody smiling. I think Ira did the mum plan one year or may have assisted on it. A Torah was donated to the congregation by Sam and Hannah Sinis of Philadelphia in honor of Maurice and May Rosenfield, their Nat's parents. The Ladies' Aid Society was founded in 1922 to manage a religious school. Yeah, that's what usually happens. And it's always the ladies that end up managing it. And also to contribute to charitable causes. And in 1928, they affiliated with the National Federation of Temple Sisterhoods. Well, they didn't have a building. We had a congregation. Everybody thinks, you know, a town and the temple. It's not the temple, it's the congregation. You don't have to have a building. They started off meeting in Ziegler's drugstore on the second floor. And in other years after that, they met in the Rainwater Building for a while, at the YMCA, and finally at the Masonic Temple. In 1949, Dr. Michael Morris, who was a pharmacist, donated the land right here. You're on Park Avenue. That's where you got to build a synagogue. Got to be on Park Avenue. It impresses my friends from New York. Wouldn't go anywhere else. But he donated the land for the synagogue. The union provided blueprints, because you'll see several that have the same model if you look at small congregations around the country. The building committee, Dr. Morris, Dr. Abe Greenberg, we've already heard his name mentioned today, and Mr. Isidore Stein, they managed the building construction. It was completed in July 1949, so the building was put up pretty quick. And they invited Rabbi Philip Frankel of Charlotte to lead the formal dedication service. And they had about 25 families at the original building. This is what it looked like. Now, the inside of the synagogue, right where I'm standing, which is about right here, this is what it looked like. Not like this. You can see the ark back there. They had the pull curtain, and it was kind of backed off. You see the lions of Judah, which are now, actually, they were taken off the wall when we redid the social hall, but they were on the wall in there. And this was the first wedding held at Beth Israel in February 1952 of Barbara Ginsburg and one of our congregates, Sigmund Kornblut. Thank you, Harold, for getting me the picture. This one went in last night. So, we've got a building. It's after World War II. This is where we grew. We had 25 families. That's not enough to afford a full-time rabbi. So we relied on services from Charlotte, from Columbia, from Sumter, on different rabbis to come in as spiritual leader. But Florence was growing. And as more people came to town, more Jewish families came to town. So our congregation increased. They started looking for a rabbi to come as our rabbi. And the first rabbi in 1952 was Rabbi Tibor Fabian. Sorry for the quality. I had a hard time finding some of the pictures, but this was the best one we could get. The following year, we had Rabbi Morris Clark. And he had a real interest in music, and he formed a choir, which added a different dimension to services in the congregation. Got an organ, and so they had choir music to go along with the Reform service. From 1954 to 58, Rabbi Jonah Grossfield led the congregation. And he even formed a children's choir. Ricky Levy, who's that? That's Ricky's mom in the background right here. Okay. Little one on the front row right here, other side. There we go. Okay. All right, so we're finally finding some people in the audience here. Okay. He stayed for 4 years. Following his tenure, they weren't able to get a full-time rabbi, but they were able to get rabbinic students from Hebrew Union College in New York. And we had Jay Krause and Paul Kushner from Hebrew Union College. That's Rabbi Krause there teaching religious school. And every 2 weeks, one of them would fly from New York to Florence. Back, you could get a direct flight then, believe it or not. And they would lead services and hold religious school. This is Rabbi Krause boarding the plane at LaGuardia Airport. This was an article in the New York Times. Excuse me? Yes? Right here? Okay. See? He did go to Sunday school. His mother made him go. In 1960, the congregation was served by Rabbi Eli Gottsman, who was a circuit-riding rabbi. He had a bus and traveled all over the Carolinas. That sounds strange, doesn't it? I found out a little bit about him. I Googled him, and he got into some trouble with the law in Canada. It had to do with illicit narcotics or something, and this was about 6 or 8 years ago. Google is an interesting tool for research. You can't hide anymore. Anyway, so for a couple of years we had Rabbi Gottsman. The congregation now was around 50. They searched for a full-time rabbi to come, and we got Rabbi Charles Lesser, and he stayed for 9 years. Now, this is a rabbi that I remember. Big, intimidating rabbi if you were 6 years old. Wore the robe. Okay, classical Reform. I know a lot of you in the audience remember him. The congregation grew during his tenure to about 70 families. This was our real growth period. The community had about 160 individuals, and it grew to about 285. This is men, women, and children. The men's club affiliated with the National Federation of Temple Brotherhoods back in the late 50s, early 60s. The religious school with a full-time rabbi here was growing and vibrant. They had 30 to 35 kids, and we outgrew the building. Now, if you look over here at the back where the thermostat is, to the indention of the wall behind the first thing, that's about where you had an accordion door. And you walked through the accordion door, pulled it open, and there was a social hall going on back. So this wasn't a real big building. These little rooms back here were used as classrooms. The room over there was the kitchen and another little classroom. So it was a very small building. It was big because I was about this high. But, we outgrew the building. So they bought the land over to the left. Two little houses were there. They demolished the houses in 1967. They made plans to add classrooms, a new kitchen, a social hall, and to make the sanctuary bigger. They raised funds, enough to build the building. Not quite enough to get the pews, but that's another story. It caused great consternation for presidents after that. But funds were raised, and on the end of February 1969, our building committee, Nat Rosenfeld, Herb Levy, Ray Walpert, Herman Ensel, Arthur Siegel, Rabbi Lesser, Eric Heiden, where is he? Out there somewhere. Notice the handsome 14-year-old in the background. We had great arguments over when this was. I can promise you, look at the coats they're wearing. It was cold that day, and what are these old fools doing? Let's go back inside where it's warm. So, spring of 1969, this is what the building looked like then. Got a building permit, which didn't show up too good. That's your view from Pine Street, standing over here looking this way. That's the view from the rear of the building. And this is what we had completed in June 1970, our building as it looks today. So, 1970, we had a newly renovated building, an active congregation, and we would dedicate the congregation. And at this time, we changed rabbis, and we got a new young rabbi named Howard Fulb. He was here for the installation in November 1970. He came that summer. He was 28 years old, right out of HUC, pretty green.
He was a classmate of my father. They're a good friend.
Now, he was a great guy. Now, I was in youth group at the time. David, it was a little bit before your time. He came to the congregation. He talked to everybody. He talked to the youth group. They were going to vote on him the next day. The youth group got on the phone and called every member of the congregation and said, "Vote for this guy. He is really good." I'm serious. We actually did that. His arrival saw an increase in the social activities and the religious activities. The youth group had 20 members during those early years. We used to host statewide conventions. The Brotherhood and Sisterhood were having trouble getting people to come to events. There weren't quite enough to get some things going, and they merged. And it was the first merger of a Brotherhood and Sisterhood in the Union's history. Religious school enrollment got over 40 students. He had a really good education. He had confirmation training, bar and bat mitzvah training, Hebrew school. It was very active. This was a confirmation class. Who's that guy right there? That's my little sister. That's David Levitt sitting in the back row.
Why were the girls barefoot?
Huh?
Why were the girls barefoot?
I didn't ask that question. Probably. That's Charles Levy's bar mitzvah. He's the son of Aaron Levy. The congregation grew during the 70s. Other congregations, the one in Darlington, was shrinking. Dillon was starting to shrink. This was a problem. And Rabbi Fulb used to go over to Darlington and Dillon, sometimes to King Street, and work with these congregations. In the late 70s, members of Darlington's congregation, several of whom had kids in religious school, were absorbed into this congregation as it became non-functional. And this became the real center of Judaism for the PD area. In 1981, Rabbi Sidney Strom came. He was toward the end of his rabbinic career, and he was a really nice man. He gave lovely sermons. He and his wife Marjorie loved to entertain, and they often had congregants in their home. Unfortunately, his health got pretty poor, and in 1984, he was forced to retire a little early, and he remained in Florence until 1990 when he died. Rabbi Fulb came in 1984. Excuse me, Rabbi Marr. We'll get through this. During his tenure, the congregation was changing. The owners of the textile mills and the merchants were being replaced by doctors and lawyers and CPAs. So the face of the congregation was changing a lot. Ohev Shalom Congregation during his tenure was growing smaller, and it became harder and harder to stay open, and many of its congregants started coming to Beth Israel. The membership at the time of about 1990 increased to 90 families or about 50 kids enrolled in the religious school. We actually had some kids coming over from Sumter. Rabbi Marr encouraged the establishment of the Beth Israel Endowment Fund. Seed money was donated by Arthur and Shirley Siegel. And this became a reality. We raised the first $100,000 and had a big party in 1991. And you have Bruce Siegel and Judy Kammer here with our foundation board that's out in the foyer. Rabbi Marr understood the union better than any rabbi I've ever seen, particularly. He'd always worked with small congregations. He knew how to get the union to send speakers and musicians, and it really helped. He encouraged congregants to become involved in regional and national committees of the union and arranged for two of the congregants to be trained as lay leaders, rabbinic aides, to assist him and to be able to perform life cycle events in his absence. In 1995, Rabbi Mark Klein came with his family, an attorney who decided to go to rabbinic school. He and his wife Cindy and their kids came, and it was a real change for the congregation from a couple of older rabbis to one that was young with young children. This place became very kid-friendly. He introduced more Hebrew and more traditional practices because that's where Reform Judaism was going. He was really committed to social justice. He was very involved in the community. He worked 25 hours a day, 7 or 8 days a week. He encouraged kids to take part in the services. He wrote a lot of alternative services, and these were utilized in some of the things still to this day. After Rabbi Klein left, 8 years later, we had trouble getting a full-time rabbi. So we turned to the union, and we were a little late, but they said, wait a minute, we've got a student that's coming from Leo Beck School named Malcolm Cohen, and he's going to be here for 1 year, and we can let y'all have him. So he came down from HUC in New York a couple of times a month, and he taught religious school, he led services, we got him a rental car, he rode all around and visited people, and it was a great experience for him and for us. We still had problems, so we needed another part-time rabbi, and we were fortunate enough, by pulling a string or two, we found one that had retired. His name was Alvin Sugarman. So he would come to the congregation for several days a month. He'd been at the temple in Atlanta, a little shul there on Peachtree. Got about 1,700 members last count. But we were very fortunate to have him. He was a real mensch. And after about a year, he said he had to give it up because he was coming a couple of times a month and his wife wanted him home in Atlanta. And quite frankly, he told me after he retired, he was busier than he'd ever been. We were able to get Rabbi Ronald in 2005, and he was with us for 6 years as our leader. He brought a deep knowledge of Jewish thought and wisdom to the congregation. He represented us in the Florence community and the greater PD community as a whole, and really brought a Jewish presence to interdenominational events and social justice activities. But as time goes on, we have the problems that 550 congregations around the union have. The kids grow up, they're educated, they go to college, and they don't come back home. The congregation was shrinking. The economy was turning down. The religious school was down to a dozen students or less. And of course, inflation, it's hard to keep your doors open. And we were unable to afford to have a full-time rabbi. Just couldn't afford it. So for the last year and a half, our congregation has had two part-time rabbis. They come once a month, Rabbi Aaron Sherman and Rabbi Leah Dobnashor. And we are fortunate to have them. So that's pretty much the history of Beth Israel over the last 100 or so years and the general history of Florence and the PD area. Tomorrow morning, we'll talk a little bit, very briefly, about Darlington. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex. That was great. I'm Rachel Barnett. I'm president of Jewish Historical Society, and it is our pleasure to be here in Florence to celebrate with all of you. I remember Rabbi Volb, actually, very well, because I was part of TYG, as I wrote in my note to the in the newsletter. But we lost our rabbi in Sumter about that time, and those of us that were to be confirmed that year would come over to Florence, and we joined the confirmation class over here. So I have my own memories of the synagogue very well.